Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Discover More, where we strive to accelerate the learning process together through intentional dialogues. My name is Benoit.
And my name is Aiden. This podcast was built on the foundation of approachable guests, synthesized experiences, and relatable lessons that will help you grow throughout your journey. Thank you for tuning in this week. We hope you enjoy and continue to discover more. Hey, good morning, everyone. We hope you had a great weekend. In this week's episode, we continue our conversation with Matthias Wiest, a gifted math teacher and endurance athlete. We discuss his recent move to Rwanda and how the new culture has impacted his relationship with time and efficiency. We also explore Matthias' passion for mathematics, what it's taught him about life, as well as its connection with music. Whether it's math, music, endurance sports, or new cultures, it's clear that Matthias pursues knowledge for the sake of knowledge. This disciplined yet multidisciplinary approach has allowed him to complete rigorous academic and athletic achievements, move halfway across the world for love, and ultimately live a happy and balanced life. We hope you enjoy this episode of Discover More with us and Matthias Wiest. Thank you.
Absolutely. And I would like to kind of jump into what you mentioned of that. That's definitely changed in the recent months since you've moved to Rwanda. Sure. How has that change impacted your relationship with time or relationship with goals and structure, and kind of what's that's taught you about the way you were, you know, living up until that point of moving over there?
Yeah. I mean, I think relationship with time is a huge part of that. So my job in Rwanda is, I would say it is not as demanding time-wise as my job in Philadelphia was. On top of that, in general, life in Rwanda is a lot more flexible. People understand if you're a little bit late. People understand if you have to, you know, change the date for something. I think in a way which is not as accepted in the U.S. It's been refreshing for me because, again, I've in general been very structured and rigid, and to basically be forced to be a little bit more flexible, I thought I would be anxious because of it, but actually I'm able to be more flexible because there is the time for that. I have the time for that. I don't have to be as structured as I had to in the past couple of years. Like, again, I said earlier, efficiency is born out of necessity. I would say I'm still an efficient person. So maybe a better way of putting it would be that structure and rigidity is born out of necessity, right? In Rwanda, the necessity to get a lot of things done in a short amount of time, or to get multiple things done in a short amount of time, is nowhere near as pressing as it has been here. I'm still extremely driven by my professional goals, by my personal and athletic goals, and I'm still balancing the two of those things. But right there, there isn't the pressure to be on constantly.
So we do have international audiences, but last time I checked, we don't have any Rwandan listeners. So I'm geographically challenged, so I don't really know anything. Actually, I don't know anything about Rwanda. I'm sure many of the listeners don't. My question is just, I want to stay on this topic for a little bit longer. You think that flexibility with time, or that relationship, or the shift in relationship with time, of course, is necessitated by the condition they're in, which is Rwanda, right? Is that like a cultural thing? You think it's culturally speaking, they're more flexible with time, whereas in here, it's such a capitalistic society where everything's like, you're on this go mode all the time because grind never stops, 24/7, sleep when you're dead, So I wonder if it's like a culture difference, or is it because it's just like the particular organization you work in? But I'd like you to touch a little bit more about the cultural piece and what Rwanda is like overall.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely cultural, and while I don't think I can really speak to even work culture broadly in Rwanda. I can definitely speak to work culture here in the United States. Here in the US, it's exactly as you say, like you're expected to constantly be producing, you're expected to constantly be, you know, meeting certain deadlines. There's a certain inflexibility in general to how a lot of work is structured. And I mean, yeah, in Rwanda, just for context, a small country in Eastern Africa. It's bordered to the west by the Democratic Republic of the Congo and to the east by Tanzania. So just some points of reference there. Most people probably know it for the genocide, which is a tragic yet important part of the history. That was in the early 90s, for anyone who doesn't know. So that's been 25 years now, 26 years. And since then, really, Rwanda has seen a sea change in its economy, in its political stability. Currently, they're trying to model themselves as the Singapore of Africa. Take that for what you will. But it's a very clean, generally, it's a very well-structured country, and it's not very hectic at all. That being said, I mean, yeah, people are... It's not the United States when it comes to getting things done efficiently, and sometimes that's infuriating when you're waiting for 4 hours at immigration. Not coming into the country. Visit Rwanda. It's a cool place. More like if you're trying to get a visa. But other times it's like, you know, hey, you know, my car's not starting. I'm going to see the mechanic. And, you know, your boss is not like, that's unacceptable. Your boss is like, you know, okay, do what you got to do. We'll cover for you. And then the expectation is like, you know, maybe, you know, that happens to your coworker, and then you cover for them. And there's a certain understanding there. Certainly true for my organization, from the people I've talked with, is definitely more consistent in Rwanda than it is here in the U.S., in the United States. Yeah.
Do you find it more relaxing being in an area like that? I know you mentioned specifically going out to dinner or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, like, I guess, is it just a completely different pace, or what is, I guess, the relationship that it's had on you and just your enjoyment levels for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely gotten accustomed to it, and I think that is, like, by necessity. Like, I thought that waiting an hour for food would be stressful and frustrating, but, like, there's no other option, really. Like, you better get used to it. And I have, and I've accepted that, and now it's fine. Yeah, but before I moved to Rwanda, like, I was hesitant that, like, you know, my personality of, you know, getting things done efficiently, you know, if I'm going out for errands, I'm gonna, you know, tick off 3 boxes at once. Like, that isn't going to happen in Rwanda, because, you know, sometimes the grocery store doesn't have what you expect it to have. Mm-hmm. And just learning to live with that and to be okay with that. It's been an area of personal growth, but it's one that I'm I think I'm pretty happy with how that's developing. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's great to hear. And even to go a little bit further, one saying that I guess is out there a lot is discipline is freedom, freedom is discipline. Mm. Right? And I'm sure being that structured and goal setting, like, that probably rings a lot of bells for you, but coupled with the fact that you just, you know, spent this time in Rwanda, has that flexibility impacted that idea, or what do you kind of think of that saying overall?
I'd say that before I moved out there, definitely discipline is freedom was how I navigated the world. I think that's still true. But yeah, my new reality is that, like, you know, things are a lot more flexible, and to learn to live with that, to learn to live with that freedom, if you will, it's a constant area of growth. But I'm definitely learning that there are many ways that you can get something done, and you know, it's kind of crazy, because, you know, that's something, Yeah, it took until university for me to really learn about math, if we'll, you know, sort of bring it full circle. It's something which I've learned through experience in terms of athletics. And now in terms of living, right, in terms of balancing, you know, priorities, balancing your life, there are multiple ways to do that. And yeah, it is very dependent on where you live and, you know, the culture of that place. But I can still be who I am. I can still have multiple priorities, multiple goals, a generally balanced person, I would say. I can be that in the United States, and to this point, I can still be that in Rwanda. So
Matthias, very well said. And I know you talked about your finding balance between whatever condition that you put in. And of course, I think different people serve as different pillars in your life that helped you with that transition piece, because you did transition from the United States to Rwanda, which is across the world. So I do want to ask you about who or what prompted it and what made you to literally move across the world, right? And B, whatever that is, how was that person or how was that thing supports you throughout and really helps you be grounded in Rwanda, in a different culture, a different universe, different world?
Bit of a leading question, Benoit. It's almost as if you know I have a girlfriend. There's one major reason I moved to Rwanda, and that is the fact that my girlfriend Nicole had been living there, working there for a year prior. She is not a U.S. citizen, so her options after graduation, she also went to Northwestern, were a bit limited. Ultimately found an incredible position working at a nonprofit called One Acre Fund in Rwanda. So she manages a lot of their internal systems, their global human resources. More importantly, she found that life in Kigali, which is the capital of Rwanda, is very wonderful. I was lucky enough to visit in November of 2018. And I saw that it's a place that I could live in. And you know, beyond that, Nicole's been such a huge part of my life over the past over 5 years now. Despite the fact that we had never actually shared an apartment or house or anything, and we had been long distance for 2 years. So to finally, after Teach for America, you know, hit that finish line, hit that end goal, to have the opportunity to move to Rwanda to continue my professional career out there. I feel very fortunate that I've been able to do that. When you put it bluntly, I moved halfway around the world for love, which is wonderful in so many ways. But it was also very important to me that I continue my, you know, professional development as well. And I knew that I wanted math to be a part of that. I wanted teaching to be a part of that. And ultimately where I found work at Bridge to Rwanda, they've given me the flexibility and the opportunity to practice that. Now Nicole's been very supportive in my move. Very helpful in setting up our house. Basically, she made the transition so much smoother than I could have ever imagined. It didn't feel like I was moving to Rwanda. It felt like I was moving in, and it was very natural. Beyond that, she's put up with a lot of my crazy endeavors, and I do appreciate that. So it's... yeah, it's been an adventure, but it's also it's been incredibly normal, which is wonderful. And I feel that I can continue being myself in Rwanda. I can continue pursuing my goals in a completely different context. And Nicole's definitely made that possible.
Yeah, I've only I guess, hung out with Nicole once when she visited. Mm-hmm. And I do have a limited exposure to her. But from my experience and my, I guess, context with you, because I've known you for a while now, with rooming together and going through the shared struggle, so to speak, through Teach for America experience. But when I look at your life, everyone has a certain amount of constants and a lot of things that come and go. But the two things that have been constant in your life have been mathematics and Nicole. So I'm sure those two definitely can be reflected upon through experience. And so far in the show, that those have been very, very solid and concrete pillars in your life. Yeah. So.
Yeah, huge foundation, definitely.
Yeah, well said, Ben. So considering that other pillar being mathematics, one thing that I've been always fascinated with is the relationship with mathematics and music. I know you mentioned that you played piano for 18 years growing up into college, and then you also were very into classical music, kind of as that performance downtown in Philadelphia. So what's been your experience with that relationship, or navigating them together? Are they complementary with each other, or how's that been navigating that relationship for you?
Yeah, so I mean, it's many people might view, you know, music as very, very soft, and you know, it's a wonderful art form. Mathematics is very analytical, very rigid, very inflexible. But it's a good question you bring up, because there's so much fluidity and so much, you know, there's such a strong relationship between the two. And it definitely took me a while to figure that out. Now, admittedly, I did play the piano, which is, you know, some might consider one of the most mathematical instruments. You've got both hands working at the same time, right? You've got different rhythms, which you have to overlay with one another. Music as a whole, though, is really all about how those rhythms interact, overlap, and how the performer can make those their own. So I mean, one particular instance comes to mind. I played piano throughout my childhood, and one of the pieces I prepared for my senior recital is a piece by Debussy, in which you have triplets in the right hand, overlaid with with eighth notes in the left hand. So triplets being three beats which fit inside one count, so you split one note, you split one beat into three parts, and the eighth notes being one beat split into two parts. So if you overlay those, right, that's not going to match nicely, right? Two and four matches nicely because, right, four divides into two. Three does not divide into two nicely. So I'm sitting here, my right hand's supposed to be counting in threes, my left hand is supposed to be counting in twos, and I am at a complete loss. And that's because, right, I'm trying to approach it very rigidly. I'm trying to approach it very mathematically. And it took a while, and it took a lot of listening to other recordings, to other pieces where this shows up. But it's really not about how three and two fit together. It's about how the piece of music progresses as a whole, right? You have a run in the right hand. You have like a different type of run in the left hand, or a different way of counting in the left hand. And the start point might be the same, the end point might be the same, but in the middle something else is happening. Well, guess what? It's all about just getting from that start point to the end point in the most fluid way possible. And when you do that, you still are following these mathematical principles of overlaying three and two, but you're doing so in such a way that, like, you are owning that music. You're making it sound beautiful. And in that pursuit of beauty, you find mathematics, which yeah, that came out much more poetic than I expected. But it's definitely something which I realized as I became more and more involved in piano. Now, yeah, I mean, you can dive into so much in terms of music, right? At the end of the day, music is sound waves, it's physics, right? And it's different frequencies and harmonics and how they interact, and, you know, why does this sound, you know, pleasing to one individual but not to another? But yeah, at the base of that, math is a huge foundation. It's patterns. Yeah, it's all about patterns.
What is that as to why it sounds pleasant to some and displeasant to others? Is it harmonies between certain notes or different frequencies working together? I guess for people that don't know music super well, what's kind of the base? I mean, I personally play a few instruments, so there's the frequency matching to certain notes, and certain notes go together, but I'm definitely not super fluent with math, especially at a high level. What's kind of the bridge that might connect the two at a more, I guess, theoretical level? Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, right. Within your notes, you have, you know, each note corresponds to a certain frequency, which is just a measure of, you know, how, right, frequency is how often, right, it will hit your ear. And the higher the frequency, the higher the corresponding pitch in what your brain processes. And you can have different amplitudes, right? So larger waves versus smaller waves, and that corresponds with the volume that you're hearing. So I guess that touches more on the nitty-gritty side of things. I think it is a really interesting question as to, like, you know, why do some people like certain sounds versus others? And there are some sort of more universal sounds that sound pleasing to people's ears, like, you know, maybe a minor third chord, you know, elicits a given emotion among most of the population. It's like, why is that? Is that evolved? Is that learned? It's a question which I most certainly don't have an answer for. But yeah, that connection between music and the underlying physics and math is a remarkable one.
Especially in two seemingly so different avenues, right? Because yeah. I think the common perception of music is very go with the flow,
yeah.
Intuitive. Like, I know personally a lot of my most talented musicians are two of my cousins, and they're both completely all ear. They can hear something, yeah, and then play it right away. Can't read a lick of music, but it's all that internal hearing it upstairs and being able to transfer it right down. But then on the flip side, there's the mathematical approach with sight reading and how the different modalities all work together. So it's just such a unique dichotomy between the two, of two such seemingly unrelated things, that is really fascinating that you're kind of living both of them at the same time.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it comes back to the point that, like, you know, there are always, you know, many, many ways to do things, and people's brains process things differently. And I mean, I think it's beautiful that, like, even, you know, people who might not be very good at math, might not consider themselves academically inclined, are able to create absolutely beautiful music using mathematical, you know, underpinnings, using rhythm, using harmonies that, you know, other people would not be able to produce. So yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful connecting point.
Mm-hmm. And maybe external to music, kind of math in, call it the world, or math in, yeah, the universe, just kind of, I'm sure you've seen that firsthand, you know, external to the textbooks, kind of how has your learnings in math, I guess, impacted the way you see the world?
No, it's a great question. And I think this is something which has also developed since I've started teaching math, but algebra is often the first subject which turns a lot of students away from math, because it's taught, it's like Benoit mentioned, right? How the hell do I teach slope, right? Like, why am I teaching slope? It's taught in a series of formulas and obscure, you know, concepts which have seemingly little relevance to students' lives. Like, students know they need to add, they know they need to multiply, right? Division is important. But, you know, once you start introducing, like, okay, slope, variables, you know, what the hell is this? Interest starts going out the window. But since I've started teaching algebra, it's really just become even more incredible, the number of places that algebra can be used, and the essence that all we're doing in algebra is finding ways to model consistency and to model change in the world, and that can be with population growth, that can be tracing out trajectories, that can be keeping, you know, using statistical models to draw conclusions, proportionality, like proportions. We're not just talking about triangles here. We're talking about sample sizes. We're talking about engineering, and really it's the more I started teaching that, the more I got sort of involved in that sort of thinking, where it's like, what we're learning, and now I'm starting to think beyond just math. What we're learning is we're not learning facts. We're learning about ways to perceive the world. So now I'm looking at my history courses. Like, I'm not learning history so I can recite dates. I'm learning history so that I can think about what has happened, and take it to the next level. Okay, so what does that mean for what's going to happen in the future? I'm looking at biology now, and when I took biology in ninth grade, it was memorization, and I hated it. But now I'm looking at, okay, how do these things actually interact? Why am I learning this? Why does that make sense? Right? Why does osmosis make any sense at all? And then you actually start thinking about, right, concentration gradients and like how stuff flows, and things become much more interconnected when you can think about the big picture and how things actually show up in the real world, how different concepts are connected.
When did you start making that transition of thinking? Because that's something that I think I personally have struggled with a lot, like kind of studying for the test, memorizing the facts, and then it literally going in one ear, staying there for even 3 hours to study for the exam, and then out the other. Like a lot of like history classes, biology classes, can't really remember. When did that learning style evolve for you? Was it after college, or when presented with a new like tidbit of information, or what did that process look like?
I'd say it started during college. I'd say it started in the math classroom with this realization that, like, math isn't about memorizing stuff. It's about figuring things out. It's about applying, the different types of problem solving you're encountering. It's about applying that to other types of problems, to other things. Also, it definitely developed as I've been teaching, right? I've sort of seen the background, if you will, to all of these things which previously I was just taught and told to memorize. So and that applies to algebra. That also applies to calculus. Like, when you take calculus, you're just told to memorize. And sure, you're starting to solve more complicated problems in creative ways, but there's still a lot of memorization there. But in college, I took real analysis, and that builds up so many of the proofs that calculus relies upon. So I think knowledge is a big part of that. I think being forced to dig deep into why something works, as I've been forced to do as a teacher, that's also been a big part of it. And then finally, I think interest is a huge part of that. Like, I've recently, since I've gotten more and more involved in endurance sports and training plans and all sorts of things like that, I've gotten very interested in how our bodies work and how our bodies process nutrients and create energy and movement. Nutrition goes along with that. Molecular biology and having that underlying interest has made, studying other topics, which, previously I had found to be very tedious and solely based in memorization, I'm able to start making connections to how this is actually applicable. in the real world, as opposed to something just on a test. Now, to be fair, I still find myself in the boat of, like, you know, I might remember something for a test and not remember it months later, years later. I mean, the amount of just stuff, pure information I processed in history classes in college, like, it's pretty incredible. I look back on some of my papers and it's like, wow, I knew a lot about that. But the takeaways are not necessarily, unless you're pursuing a PhD or something, are not necessarily the information you're actually learning, but really, like, the, you know, how you're using that information, what you're doing with it, the process of finding it, the process of making your own arguments, and that is something which I've definitely recognized a lot more.
That sounds like having a why behind what you're actually learning, full circle of, you know, why you are climbing the mountain and why you are taking all those classes. It's really having that solidified purpose of learning the specific topics, and that's ultimately what allows you to learn them at a better level, right?
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, motivation. You have to find your own motivation. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, in addition to the core of why, is that you're approaching life through this multidisciplinary approach or holistic approach, because I think the current, this is a very loaded topic. I'm not going to stay on this long because this could be another 4 hours, but, like, the current education system is so severely flawed, because when the education system was first, like, founded, because we had specific issues we had to tackle and we needed to be specialized in certain fields. That's why we had all the accounting field, law, medical, because information, the access to information, was not ubiquitous back in the days, where you had to embark on a specific field to be good at it. And I think the idea of jack of many trades or jack of all trades, I don't think it's synonymous with master of none, because if you look at a lot of the guests we had on this show and a lot of high achievers nowadays, they're more of a journalist versus specialist, because you have all these, let's say Silicon Valley, for example, because we got a lot of startup founders and techies on this show, where they come from with this very rigid, or I guess rigorous, scientific background, whether it's engineering, computer science, or other similar fields, yet they're experimenting and they're, you know, I guess tipping their toes in with, like, finance, with HR, with hiring, you know, with the legality, all these, because I don't think the college sole purpose is just to learn how to learn. I think that's a very flawed model to look at the education aspect. But a lot of people nowadays, they have the intellectual hardware and the discipline to accommodate their interests in many different fields. And by having a multidisciplinary approach, you can look at things from a holistic aspect. Like, when you look at music now, and when you look at a lot of nature, the world, you have that mathematical foundation to fuel your interest in those fields. And in turn, you appreciate those, because now you know the core why and you have this approach to look at things differently. So I think that's something, the approach that you currently take on in your life, I think that's the approach that many people should take on a little bit more often, because when you're only doing certain things just to achieve certain outcome, it's a very boring way of life. And one of the main reason why we, Aiden and myself, embarked on this passion project, this podcast, we named it Discover More, because we do have that lifelong growth mindset. We do have that lifelong curiosity. We do have that jack of many traits tendencies, because I'm not very knowledgeable about everything, but I have the curiosities at least to want to be knowledgeable about a lot of things, because when you have this multidisciplinary approach in life, life is more interesting. You can talk about all these things, the conversations become more interesting, a lot more profound ideas get produced in the conversations. And I think ideas and intellectual diversity is only possible with that holistic approach. So I really appreciate you sharing that. And I think it's a very valuable thing to take away for a lot of people.
You know what they called some of the original, you know, the Renaissance men, if you will, were polymaths. Those who are interested in studying many things.
Yeah.
Now, I think the modern day Renaissance man would be quite different than the thinker back in the 15th century who, you know, had servants and, you know, a wife looking after everything else. But pursuing knowledge for the sake of knowledge, there's something to be said for that. And I also don't think that it's, jack of all trades means that you're a master of none either, right? you can be a master of one trade, you can be a master of two, and you can maintain interest in a lot of things, and you can apply your learnings from one field into quite a number of fields. And I think that's something everyone should keep in mind.
Awesome. Thanks, Mathias. So one of the questions that we always end our episodes with is really just your biggest pieces of advice. I think there's obviously so much content out there that's these days with, you know, conflicting perspectives and ideas, but especially as an educator who's gone through so much, what are your biggest pieces of advice for either children or young adults looking to make a difference in the world?
Yeah, good question. Definitely, as an educator, this is something that's on my mind quite a bit. You know, what do I want to model for my students? And ultimately, I think the biggest thing I can try to bring out from my students is confidence. And this is sort of related to a lot of what we've talked about tonight. And it's really interesting because I never really thought of myself as a confident person growing up. But the confidence, which I'm referring to, is really the confidence that, like, if you put in the work, right, that if you put in the work consistently, that will take you wherever you want to go. That will take you to whatever your goals are. A lot of times, the only thing that's preventing that is, well, it is the test anxiety, is the event anxiety, which Benoit mentioned earlier. Now, if I can teach others to be confident, you know, to carry confidence from their training, from their studies into whatever their goal is, I'd be very happy indeed. I'd say in addition to that, right, finding what motivates you, finding a goal which you can set for yourself, and beyond just that, right, finding what you need to do so that doesn't become your entire life, right? Finding things to balance that. And if you can do that, if you can set yourself a goal and consistently work toward it, right, by staying balanced, by staying focused, your consistency and your hard work will take you through to that goal.
Spoken truly by the educator himself. So we would like to end this episode by asking, so what is next for you? Accomplished such a major task of Everesting, thriving in Rwanda, all these things you've checked off your list, so to speak. So what is next? Are you working on any exciting opportunities? But yeah, what is the future, whether it's near future or distant future, look like for you?
I think I'll stay off the bike for the next couple weeks at least. So yeah, I guess most simply transitioning my goals, my athletic goals a bit in the new year to focus a bit more on running, just sort of exploring all the different avenues of athletics that I haven't really had the chance to fully experience after starting rowing. So yeah, I'll be running a lot more. There's a 14-mile race in Rwanda that's coming up. I might try to target a marathon over the summer. Beyond that, I've become really interested in how mathematics can be applied to biology and sports science, and right, basically how our bodies work and produce energy. And I'm starting to look into areas of further research in terms of grad school for applied math in these research fields. One area of study which is definitely growing pretty quickly is bioinformatics. It sort of takes a data science view on you know, biology, medical research, genetics, basically how do we deal with large data sets. And yeah, something I'm starting to look into more seriously. So possibly within the next couple of years, I'm going to grad school to study that. Might be in the US, might be in the UK, might be elsewhere, but I think I'm leaving my pathways pretty open there. Yeah, so very excited to see what the future holds and how I can, you know, maintain my goals and my training and my general interests in life as circumstances change.
Yeah, I think with the democratization of data, it's I think the possibilities are endless, right? There's just so much data out there, and the field and just variations, the combining of fields, I think it's super fascinating. So, but yeah, we really appreciate you, Professor Weiss, with all the wisdom that you shared with us and the audiences. And I look forward to your debut on the Olympic stage with the
triathlon
in the future. No, but on a serious note, we really do appreciate you, you know, flying however long flight that is and coming straight on a Friday night, recording this with us for this almost 3 hour long form interview. And I really appreciate your time. And this conversation has been very, very profound and extremely fascinating for myself. And I'm sure Aiden as well. But thank you so much for on the show, and good luck with everything.
It's been a wonderful opportunity. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Discover More. We release a new episode every Monday on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and would really appreciate if you have subscribed and shared this with your friends.
We hope you enjoyed this episode, and join us next week in the journey of discovering more through intentional dialogues.